You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, UW-Madison's Rose Lavelle became a household name as a player on the U.S. women's soccer team in 2019. We'll hear about her World Cup performance, the upcoming Olympics, and the quest for a level playing field for women's sports. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments yesterday in a case that could have a big impact on what kinds of voting restrictions states are able to put in place. The case involves a challenge from the Democratic National Committee of two Arizona laws that plaintiffs say would have a disproportionate impact on minority voters and run afoul of the Voting Rights Act. Those arguments come as Wisconsin, Georgia, and many other states around the country consider their own changes to election laws. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you watching this Supreme Court case out of Arizona? Are you worried about what it could mean for the future of the Voting Rights Act and election laws in other states? And as a lot of states revisit their voting laws, are there changes you'd like to see? Are there changes you're worried about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Adam Liptak covers the U.S. Supreme Court for the New York Times. Adam, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here.
All right, we've got a really particular case here with potentially big general outcomes. Let's start with the particular. What are these cases about?
So Arizona enacted two voting restrictions. One requires ballots cast at the wrong precinct to be thrown out, and the other forbids almost anybody from collecting ballots and bringing them to the polling place, so-called ballot harvesting, according to critics. And those two restrictions were challenged under the Voting Rights Act, a 1965 civil rights law that forbids restrictions that have a disproportionate effect on minority groups.
And there are very particular cases, and the court could rule, I guess, narrowly on them. There's a thought, though, that their ruling in this case could open the door to a lot of other changes to voting laws, basically setting aside another portion of the Voting Rights Act. What are the big implications people are watching for, Adam?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Rob. Whether these particular restrictions live or die is not that important, not that interesting. And even the Biden administration, which generally opposes voting restrictions, doesn't have a problem with these particular voting restrictions. The larger question, though, is how much teeth the Voting Rights Act has in allowing challenges to the hundreds of voting restrictions that state legislatures all around the country are considering to combat what most experts say are baseless claims of election fraud, and how the court decides this case out of Arizona will affect what kinds of lawsuits can be filed in the future to take issue with the new voting restrictions, which many of them will have a disproportionate impact on minority voters.
And so the change, the new landscape, again, depending on the outcome, could be it doesn't matter if the outcome of a law has a disproportionate effect on minority voters, as long as, I guess, the intent of the law wasn't the avowed intent of the law wasn't to do that. Is that about right?
That's a pretty good shorthand. That's one key distinction. Did the legislature intend to discriminate against minorities, or did the law merely have the effect of disadvantaging minorities? It gets a little more complicated in the weeds. The court may decide that only laws that have a substantial negative impact on minorities count. It may also say you can have a substantial negative impact on minorities if you have a good justification for it. Like combating voter fraud.
When is a ruling expected on this?
I would imagine at the end of June. This is one of the biggest cases of the term. It's probably the biggest voting rights case in a decade, and the court tends to decide the biggest cases at the end of its term in the last days of June.
And as we wrap up, Adam, I know everybody who follows the Supreme Court says don't try to guess the outcome based on the questions and the attitude of the justices. But did they tip their hands in any way on this one?
I'd be surprised if the Arizona restrictions survived. I think they'll probably fall. But what's I think they'll probably be sustained. But what kinds of rules the court puts in place, how much it tightens up the restrictions on the Voting Rights Act is hard to say, as you say.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Good to be with you.
Adam Liptak is a Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times. Ken Mayer joins us now, professor of political science at UW-Madison, affiliate faculty member at the La Follette School of Public Affairs. He and some of his colleagues filed an amicus brief in support of the plaintiffs challenging the Arizona laws. Ken, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you again.
Can you tell us why you're watching this case closely and why you decided to help file a brief in it?
Well, the brief that I filed with some colleagues around the country was on a very specific question, which was about the prevalence of voter fraud, because that's the justification that is almost always offered for all manner of very restrictive voting rules, everything from voter ID to registration maintenance and voter purges. And we're seeing this after the November election, that the Brennan Center at NYU has noted that there are close to 200 restrictive voting laws that have been introduced around the country, in Georgia, in Arizona, in Pennsylvania, that are all sort of jousting with this phantom that there was some kind of massive fraud in the 2020 election, which is, you know, it's not just false. I mean, and I'm using this language carefully, it is a lie, because the people who were making those claims know that there was no election fraud, but they're offering these laws out of a justification that there's absentee ballot fraud, that the way the ballots came in, you know, all of the things that former President Trump did in the weeks before the January 6th insurrection. And so, you know, the danger here is not, as Adam Liptak said, whether the Arizona laws rise and fall. I mean, these restrictions are not, you know, they are not the sort of thing that has a massive effect. Although, you know, I think that the ballot harvesting, or what is more properly called third party ballot collection, you know, has become kind of a phantom where people claim without any evidence that there's all kinds of massive fraud and that you have to restrict it, ignoring the fact that particularly in Arizona and other places like Montana or any place that has a significant Native American population who live on Native lands and reservations, they simply don't have access to the kind of mail service that most people have. And so it can actually play an important role. But again, the fear of people who look at this case and think that this is going to be the Supreme Court taking another whack at what's left of the Voting Rights Act, is that they will allow legislatures to enact laws that have identifiably disparate impacts and that make it harder for members of minority groups to vote and to participate. But as long as you can articulate something that looks like a pretext, as long as it's not obvious that it's a complete pretext, the danger is that the court will articulate a principle that, you know, as long as the legislature said that, well, we're trying to enhance the integrity of the elections, that the courts will let those restrictions stand, and that could have an enormously suppressive effect on the rights of vulnerable populations to vote.
And that takes us back to the reason for the Voting Rights Act to exist in the first place. We had, you know, the post-Civil War, the Reconstruction Amendments saying you can't stop people from voting, and Congress has the authority to intervene if you do at the state level. Supreme Court rulings saying Congress can't do that, and then all these states having, you know, literacy tests, things like that, that didn't use words about race, but everybody knew had the disproportionate impact. I mean, those kind of things are why we had that law in the first place, right?
Well, that's true, and there's an even more important element, is that the first version of the Voting Rights Act, the one that was passed in 1965, that in 1981, the Supreme Court interpreted the act to require anyone challenging a voting practice had to show intent, that they had to show that the people enacting that law were acting with the intent to deny minorities the right to vote. So in 1982, which was the when the Congress reenacted or reauthorized the Voting Rights Act, they put in very specific language that said it's not the intent, it is the effect that these changes have. And the Supreme Court has already dismantled Section 5, the section of the Voting Rights Act that required covered jurisdictions, mostly in the Deep South, but Arizona was also covered, that any changes to their laws, voting laws, had to be pre-cleared by the Justice Department. And the Supreme Court in Shelby County in 2013 threw that out by saying that the coverage formula that identifies which states and jurisdictions that are covered by that's flawed, and so that's gone. In 2016, in a case from Texas called Perez versus Abbott, the court articulated a principle that state legislatures are presumed to be acting with, you know, proper or innocent intent when they're enacting laws, which makes it harder to, if you can show intent, then it's game over, the practice falls. But that case had the effect of making it harder to show intent. And now the fear is that this will give the court an opportunity to restrict the ability to show an effect, that will require a higher threshold and make it easier for legislatures to enact voting laws that have the effect of discriminating against minority voting populations.
We're talking to Ken Mayer, professor of political science at UW-Madison, about a Supreme Court case looking at two Arizona laws, whether they violate the Voting Rights Act, and the impact the ruling could have on the Voting Rights Act and possible changes to voting at the state level in Wisconsin and elsewhere. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the changes to voting laws being proposed in states around the country right now? Should states be allowed to make changes that have a disproportionate impact on minority voters? Do you think some of these changes are needed? Are you worried about what this case could mean for the future of voting rights? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Ken Mayer, political science professor at UW-Madison, looking at a U.S. Supreme Court case involving a challenge to two Arizona laws that plaintiffs say run afoul of the Voting Rights Act. He and colleagues filed an amicus brief in support of that challenge to those laws, focusing mainly on claims of voter fraud. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see changes to the way we vote, making it easier or more difficult here in Wisconsin? Some proposed ideas on the table among Republicans in the legislature, limiting who could automatically receive absentee ballots, requiring some kind of proof that people under 65 who say they're indefinitely confined need to be. Require voter ID for every absentee ballot someone wants, some other changes. Would you want to see those or other changes here in Wisconsin? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ken, are there voting changes you have your eye on here in the state that are, you know, currently at the early stages in the state legislature?
Well, yeah. So there are a couple of things that are kind of percolating up. Some of them have to do, well, we'll start off by saying that the 2020 election was exceptional in the sense that it was held under circumstances that are unlike anything that has happened in the last 100 years, which was in the midst of the worst public health crisis since 1918, and required a radical adaptation to how voting was conducted. And the most significant change was a huge increase in the number of or the amount of mail absentee balloting. And that took place all over the country. And in Wisconsin, typically in a presidential election, most people who vote before Election Day, they actually vote in person. People go to the clerk's office, or in Madison, you can go to any of the public libraries and you can cast a ballot early. And that's not considered absentee voting. It's considered early voting. but there weren't that many people who actually voted by mail. It was a few hundred thousand across the state. Well, that went up by a factor of 10. And now you had 1.4 million people casting mail ballots because people were concerned about the health risks of going to an in-person polling place and during COVID. And so we, as a lot of states did, you know, had to update some and revise some of the ways that some of the practices to facilitate that. And there were because I mean the reaction in the states has been entirely by Republican legislatures. I mean that's just a fact. And it has been especially noteworthy in cases or in states where Biden won the presidential election in Pennsylvania, in Georgia, in Arizona, somewhat unexpectedly. In Arizona, it was the first time that Arizona had voted for a Democratic presidential candidate since 1996 and only the second time since 1964, or second time since 1948, I think is the But anyhow, these are reactions to the fact that that was an unexpected Republican loss, and legislators and legislatures are pointing the finger at the how easy it was to get an absentee ballot, and they are identifying they place the blame unfairly on those practices and have to scale those back. So things in Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, you have to provide a copy of your qualifying voter ID the first time you request an absentee ballot. And once you do that, the clerk has it on file and you can get another one. But if you are indefinitely confined, and there's not a good statutory definition of that, that you don't have to provide a copy of your voter ID. And so people were able to decide for themselves based on guidance that they were given by some clerks around the state. And so, you know, one of the more onerous laws, and I don't think it's going to pass, and if it passed, like, I can't see that a court would uphold it, that would require anyone to who claimed that they were indefinitely confined to have a semi-annual, once every 2 years, they would have to get a doctor's note. So it would require people to go to the doctor and get certification that they were indefinitely confined. There's a proposal to require when you request and submit your absentee ballot that you have to provide a photocopy of your qualifying ID at every stage. So you even if you had submitted a copy of your ID before, that you'd have to provide a copy when you requested with your absentee ballot request, and then another copy when you turned in your absentee ballot. And again, this is the sort of thing that there is zero evidence. And when I say zero evidence, I mean zero evidence that voter ID laws do anything to enhance the security of the electoral process, because the types of the types of practices that they prevent, which is essentially voter impersonation, is just so rare that it just doesn't happen in any material amounts. And at the same time, there's no evidence that there was any material number levels of absentee ballot fraud. I mean, there's an odd case in Ozaukee County here where one person submitted the ballot for someone else, and one case in Iowa and one case in Pennsylvania, but nothing remotely of a magnitude that would have any effect on the results. There's a proposal to.
I want to jump in and take time for a caller here. Ken, Dave is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Dave, hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. I appreciate the opportunity. I've been keeping track of this, some of the argument before the Supreme Court in one case. The attorney for the Arizona in favor of these laws kind of admitted he spilled the beans of why they want to do it, But the irony seems to me to be that the Supreme Court consists, one-third of the members of the Supreme Court have been appointed by the very person who was instrumental in spreading the lies about voter fraud, which seems to, I don't want to presume the outcome by the Supreme Court, because I'm presuming that they're people of integrity, all of them, but it kind of seems to have put a finger on that scale of justice that we see out in front of the Justice Department.
Dave, thanks for the call. Dave, worried that Trump appointees on the court will rule in a particular way. On the other hand, those appointees didn't back him up on a lot of his of the former president's claims of election fraud along the way. Your thoughts on that in our last minute or so, Ken?
Yeah, well, what Dave was referring to is that one of the lawyers for the state Republican Party essentially admitted to the justices that the reason for these laws is that they would help Republicans win elections and that they would hurt Democrats. And you know, that's sort of saying the quiet part out loud. It was sort of shocking. And these justices, the Trump appointed justices, you know, refused to give any credence to the lawsuits that found their way to the Supreme Court. You know, along with Adam Liptak, I think the court will uphold these practices. And the question is how sweeping the rule they articulate will be about, you know, how future challenges can be brought against discriminatory voting practices.
Ken, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm sorry I rambled on.
That's what we're here to do.
Pleasure to be with you. Yeah.
That's Ken Mayer, professor of political science at UW-Madison. He talked to us about a case heard yesterday by the U.S. Supreme Court on two Arizona election laws and what it could mean for the future of the Voting Rights Act. Coming up, we talked to UW-Madison soccer star Rose Lavelle about her career, the upcoming Olympics, and social activism. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Madison residents got the chance over the weekend to learn about the ancient Ho-Chunk game of Snow Snake. Our guest tells us how she learned about the game and how it's played. Now, Rose Lavelle rocketed to international fame in 2019 as a new star on the U.S. women's soccer team.
Rose up the middle. Looking, cutting, shooting, go! Lavelle to another U.S.
I remember the moment I was watching with my family, and when I saw she had a chance to split the defenders, I, like a big dork, yelled, "Come on, Wisconsin." She scored in the team's World Cup final victory and left with the tournament's bronze ball award. The former UW-Madison standout is now training for the Tokyo Summer Olympics, splitting her time between the national team and an English club. WPR host Keely Boltina recently caught up with Lavelle.
The women's national team is training for the Olympic Games in Tokyo this summer, so how was it for you when those games were postponed last year because of the pandemic?
Yeah, obviously, I think we were all disappointed, but first and foremost, like, everyone's health and safety is the most important thing. So it was like completely understandable. And I think kind of by the time it got canceled, there was like, I feel like by then we kind of expected it. So it's not like it came out of the blue. I feel like we had some time to kind of digest what was going on. And yeah, grateful to hopefully have the opportunity to play there this summer if it happens. But yeah, we'll see.
How much has the pandemic affected your training for the Olympics?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody was kind of put on hold for a little bit, everybody's training. And I think we're all kind of trying to get used to this like new normal, but I think everybody's going through it. So it's not like this is like something that's unique to our team. It's like the whole world is going through this. So I think, yeah, we just have to kind of like adapt and adjust and go from there.
So much of sports is that there's this community, right? And we've seen so many stadiums just empty for good reason. But how much does playing without fans affect your game?
I wouldn't say it like affects like our game. I think obviously when there's a crowd and fans, it makes the game that much more fun because the atmosphere is so much fun to be a part of. I don't think it changes the way we play, but they're definitely missed. We love the energy that the fans bring, and they do help like give us some momentum during the game. But yeah, like I said, obviously health and safety is like the most important thing. So something that I don't think we'll ever take for granted again, and we're excited for whenever we can fill up the stadiums again.
Speaking of fun, in January, a Madison, Wisconsin soccer club announced that a cow mascot would be named Rose Cowbell in your honor, three letters off from Rose Lavelle. How do you react to that news?
Oh my gosh, yeah. It's so funny. I just think it's like so on brand for a Wisconsin sports team. And I was honored. It made me so happy. It's so cute and proudest accomplishment. I don't know if it's an accomplishment for me, but biggest honor, I should say.
Of all the things you've done, Rose Cowbell ranks up there.
Oh, yeah.
You recently moved to England to play for a club in Manchester City. How's that experience been different than your time with American clubs?
Yeah, it's been awesome. I think Manchester's been pretty locked down, so we haven't really been able to explore the city, but that's okay because I get to go and train and then come back and kind of have the rest of the day to just drink coffee and be by yourself and read a book. So that part's honestly not been too bad for me. I think the playing is great. The team is awesome. And I just wanted something that was going to kind of push me out of my comfort zone. And it's doing just that. I feel like I'm really growing both on and off the field. And yeah, it's been a great experience.
How do you assess the level of competition you're dealing with there versus your other experiences?
It's good. I mean, it's a league that like is continuing to grow and get better and attract really good players. And I think it's an exciting time for women's soccer because I think we're seeing so many different competitive leagues pop up. There's not like one single destination league that all the players need to go to get good competition. I think globally you're seeing like competitive leagues all over the place that players can play and get good games and compete against really good teams.
Rose Lavelle plays club soccer for Manchester City in England. She's a midfielder for the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team, and in college she played at UW-Madison. You're listening to this conversation on the Ideas Network. Rose, in December you spoke to UW-Madison students about executing under pressure and working through adversity. Do you feel like there's more pressure on you after winning the 2019 World Cup?
I mean, I think when you're on this team, the expectation is always high and there's always that pressure. But I think this team has always kind of thrived under those circumstances. And I think I've been lucky to be on this team with some amazing veteran players that I have gotten to learn from and see how they kind of handle and navigate all of it. So I think it's something that I'm continuing to like learn to kind of deal with and compete with. And I think it's like great. I think pressure is a privilege. And when you're put in a position that you have these pressure and expectations, it kind of makes it even more fun.
A privilege and more fun, but fame can also be really crushing for some people. After the World Cup, how have you dealt with the fact that a lot more people know who you are?
I don't know. I mean, I think after the World Cup, I would have thought that like after like I kind of accomplished this huge goal that I think we had all set out for, that I would like feel some kind of different, but I literally feel the exact same. So I don't really know if it affected me in that way, because I don't really feel any different personally. I feel like I'm just kind of going about my life the same way I always have, just now with a little more experience under my belt.
Athletes can be influential among fans, and public health authorities hope that they might be able to play a role in the pandemic by publicly endorsing vaccinations. Do you plan to get vaccinated?
Whenever it's available, I will like gladly get vaccinated. I don't really know when the timeline is that'll be like available to me, but when it is, I will. Yeah.
Because athletes play such a public role in our lives. I mean, we also saw that with social justice. From your perspective, what responsibility do athletes have to be leaders in their communities or advocates for change?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like we do have like a huge responsibility, because I think there's a lot of younger people that look up to us and want to be in our shoes one day. And I know I was that when I was younger. I like looked up to all these professional athletes and the U.S. women's national team specifically. And it's been something that I've been like really proud to be a part of. I think our team has always made some bold statements against injustices, and I feel so like proud and honored to be able to be a part of that, and hopefully help influence the younger generation in a positive way to like spark change and have them know that they are capable of doing it too.
We saw that really specifically after the killing of George Floyd last year in Minneapolis. I mean, the whole country saw athletes across sports speak out against police brutality, and they called for change. How have you seen change since then in American soccer?
I mean, I think like the biggest thing right now is kind of having those tough conversations within your team and trying to kind of get people on the same page that this is something that needs to change. It's not good enough. It's never been good enough. And although it may be better than what it's been in the past, better doesn't mean good. It can still be bad and better. I think half of it's kind of just having those conversations with your teammates, and it's not always going to be comfortable. But I think if people can kind of open their eyes and realize like we need to make this country a better place for everybody, then I think that's the direction we need to go. And hopefully the conversations can help, and then kind of doing some work behind the scenes to help like give more opportunity to everybody.
The conversation about social justice, it makes me think of the issue of equal pay. I mean, the women's national team has been seeking better working conditions and equal pay from the U.S. Soccer Federation. And in December, the sides announced an agreement on working conditions, but not on equal pay. What do you want people to know about this?
I think, like I said, we are a team that's always going to push to make things better. And we want to leave this team in a better place than for the players and girls that are coming up. And we're gonna keep pushing to do that and push for equality and push for what we know we deserve.
Why is that so critical for you?
I think because girls need to grow up and know that this is a viable option for a career, and that it's not just a man's world, that they are very capable of becoming a professional athlete and making this a career, and realize that this is like very much a realistic future for them, and that nothing can hold them back. Hopefully we can inspire people to keep pushing and that we're like on the right track.
What do you want to tell young soccer players, especially young girls who want to pursue this professionally?
I mean, I think of when I was younger, I always think I had this vision of myself of being on the national team. And I think, I would just say to younger girls, younger kids, to never doubt for one second that you could be in our shoes one day. I think the confidence that you have in yourself is going to far outweigh anybody else's opinion of you. So if you have your sights set on something, don't let anybody get in the way of that.
Did you always know that that would be your path?
I had always envisioned that this would be my path. I think I always think it's like a little weird how it actually did work out. But being on this team has always been my like where I saw my future. I looked up to the team so much and wanted to be in their shoes one day.
And now you are.
Yeah.
Rose, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That was UW-Madison alumna Rose Lavelle from the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team talking to WPR host Keely Boltina. Coming up, a member of Madison City Council talks about how she helped bring an ancient Ho-Chunk winter sport to the city last weekend. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, students often graduate without ever having picked up a musical instrument. Jen White hears from people making the case that music classes should be a key part of education. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, the Ho-Chunk winter game known as Snow Snake has been played for hundreds of years, but some Madison residents got to learn about it for the first time last weekend. That's thanks to a local alder who helped build a snowy track, gather some snakes, wooden ones that is, and arrange for lessons and competitions in a city park. Arvina Martin is an alder on the Madison Common Council. She's a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation and the Stockbridge-Muncie community. Arvina, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you found out about the game, I understand, somewhat recently. How did you come across it and decide you wanted to make it happen in Madison?
I think that I had kind of known about the game for a while, but had not really thought about it. And then in my Facebook feed, there was a posting with pictures and showing a lot of folks playing, constructing the ramp, the track, as well as playing Snow Snake up in either Toma or Black River Falls or somewhere up there, put on by the Ho-Chunk Nation. And I saw that and thought, oh, that looks so cool. Let's see if we can do this here. I messaged Bill Quackenbush, who works in heritage preservation for the Ho-Chunk Nation, and asked him, is this something that we can do here? He told me yes. And again, this was last year. And so we started to make plans and we had an event all set up. And then all the snow melted, so we couldn't do it. I reached out to him again this winter and asked how we could get this done, what kind of space we needed, and what we all needed to do in order to build this. And he's like, yep, I'll give you a hand. I'll help out. And we ended up talking to the Parks Department to see if this was something that could be held in one of the Madison City parks. The Parks Department really liked the idea and asked if this could be a Parks Department event. And I thought that was a really cool idea. So that's kind of how we got it started.
And I saw some pictures, and you're right, it does look cool. Paint us a picture of Snow Snake, what it looks like, and what we do when we play.
So this particular track that was made by Parks Department folks and Bill came up and kind of packed all the snow up to a big long ramp track building or structure. The top, the starting point, is about waist high on me. And then the track goes kind of straight, although this time we had to curve around. It goes, I think ours went about 400 feet, but I'm not I never got to the end of the track. So this track is starts waist high and kind of gradually gets lower. Then you take a log or something. I think it was maybe about the width of my hand, and we drag it through and kind of stamp it down in order to make the track. Then you take a long stick and just go to the start at the top of the ramp and try to push it down and see how far it goes. We had foot markings so people could see how far they had gone. And I think it was a great success. I had a lot of fun. And I think the people that were there had a lot of fun.
And so the stick, I think broomsticks were one option, but there are also more, I think, tradition-based snakes that you can throw down. Could you talk about those a little?
Yeah, so the Parks Department got some broomsticks that they just kind of put out. We had made the track the week before and kind of had like a soft opening, trying to see if this was going to work. And even that event on a Saturday brought more people out than we thought and actually caught attention of a lot of folks that were already at Warner Park in order to go ice skating or snowshoeing, etc. So the sticks, the non-broomsticks were what we call, well, they call them the snakes, were bigger and wooden. They look like a stick, but some are wider. There are some that are lighter and more narrow. There's there's ones that start like the front of it, the snake is wider, and then it kind of tapers off at the end. There's a lot of different ways to make them and different styles. A lot of the ones that Bill brought had traditional designs kind of etched in, or, you know, patterns that might be on a snake and maybe some snake eyes and a little mouth so you could tell where the head was. They look really cool. And, you know, that's something that somebody can make fairly easily. It might not be as ornate or as dynamic or go down the track the same way, but it's a good way to start.
Now I'm trying, as you're talking, I'm standing here and like thinking about how I would try, because I haven't seen people do this. What my technique would be? Are we doing this underhand, or I could see a sidearm, or like a frizz, or even maybe overhand? What's the right technique for sliding the snake down the groove there?
I think that, you know, you can try any of those. There's not like an official like rules way, but there is kind of a fault line that we spray painted on, so your hand can't go past that point. I kind of did a sidearm motion and twisted at my hips so I could get more power that way. We had former Ho-Chunk Nation president John Greendeer came down from Stevens Point with some of his staff and brought his own snakes, and he did running starts. And I, as a newbie, am not coordinated enough to give that a shot. So I just kind of did the stationary. But, you know, we also had some young kids. There was a 2-year-old at our kind of soft open, and he just stood there and put his hands up above his head and pushed it. And, you know, he got it here, and he got it down the track.
Now, you said you didn't make it to the end of the track. If you're willing to share, what was your best slide?
My best was 245 Ooh. Feet. Yeah.
That sounds pretty respectable. I'd be impressed by that.
I'm sorry.
Let's say it looks like fun. It sounds like a lot of fun. Can you talk about, though, helping revive this game that's played around the state, that's part of this long Ho-Chunk tradition?
Yeah, actually, this game is actually pretty common amongst tribes originally from the Great Lakes area. But I think that it traveled as well. When I had posted my on Facebook saying, we built this, we're going to give it a try, a friend of mine who is a member of the Passamaquoddy tribe of Maine said, oh my gosh, I love to play this. So this is, you know, kind of a ubiquitous game from the Great Lakes area. You know, from what I understand, it was started as kind of like a stand around game, people standing around and being like, well, what are we going to do? We're kind of bored. And, you know, in a way, maybe it's kind of like one of the lawn games, but it also has kind of practical uses, in that the motion of like kind of launching your snake down the track is similar to the motion you would make when trying to spear. So, it also was practice for something practical.
Arvina, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Arvina Martin is an alder on the Madison Common Council, a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. She talked with us about the ancient Ho-Chunk game called Snow Snake. She helped arrange lessons and competitions and a snow track in a city park over the weekend. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, meet Wisconsin artists who won honors from the National Endowment for the Arts for their work in reviving, sharing, and innovating traditional Native arts and crafts here in the state. Check it out tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then it's our week in Washington. We'll get the highlights from multiple congressional hearings investigating the events and failures of January 6th at the Capitol building, and the latest on U.S. senators taking up the coronavirus relief and recovery legislation. Remember, you can take Wisconsin Public Radio with you wherever you go. Use the WPR app on your smartphone, your digital device where you in your house, you say its name. I'm not going to say the name. You tell it to do things. It can pick up the Ideas Network too, or go online at WPR.org, or just listen on the radio. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.